So I'm actually going to totally disagree with you guys were prepared for. But it's only going to be about 4 slides. And hopefully it will be something to so how many people, just quick raise your hands, was undergraduate math and physics majors? Okay, good, 90%. How many people think they can remember what the Legendre transform is? This is like, I'm just like on a special, trying to get a feel. Okay, so I told you the Legendre transform is the thing that converts back and forth between the Lagrangian and the Hamiltonian. Do you think you can tell me what it is? Really do think about that, just for 5 seconds here. Okay, so in talking to people in this building, I would say about 40% of people can do it. They can write this down. This is a typical answer, right? So the Lagrangian is some function of Q and Q dot, the Hamiltonian is some function of Q and P. And they say, oh, you can write this down. And I say, well, okay, but this isn't a mathematical function transform in the same way that Fourier transform is, at least as you've written it like that. Not unless you also have to include your secret physics knowledge, right? Which is that P is defined that way.
Okay, so we've got this thing that's this mathematical function transform in terms of this weird substitution process, right? Because first we have to take this partial derivative of L with respect to P, and then we define H in this way, and we have to solve for Q dot on the right-hand side and stick that in to H, which is probably not like some of the other function transforms, the Laplace transform or the Fourier transform that you've heard of. This is an involution. When you go back and forth between the Hamiltonian and the Lagrangian, this is an involution. It's not so clear when you phrase the process like this. Is it always uniquely defined? So when you solve for Q dot, this is like a procedure that doesn't always have to give you a unique answer, at least given the assumptions that we've made so far. So in particular, I don't know if you were ever taught this, but the Lagrangian has to be convex in the velocity Q dot. So this will be your kinetic term, your 1/2 Q dot squared times m. And so that's another thing you have to know about it. Okay, so the Legendre transform, it's everywhere. It's not just in mechanics, it's also in thermodynamics. It seems really ugly the way we've defined it and the way almost every physicist knows it. Okay, so let's get serious then. Let's assume, well, maybe we didn't learn it very well, or most of us didn't learn it very well. And certainly I didn't know it very well, at least until I got really curious about it recently. So let's go to the definitive source, Vladimir Arnold. Right? Okay. So this is the description in the textbook. This is if you are bothering your TA for a long time and you say, I really don't understand this classical mechanics thing. None of the textbooks seem that good. And so he'll say, okay, go look at this book. It'll answer all of your questions. So I think I'm not going to say it out loud just because I don't want to spend too much time on it. But this is how he defines the Legendre transform, and it's this complicated geometric construction, okay? And I mean, it's not that complicated, but it's not so simple. It's not, certainly, I would say, it's not as simple as maybe remembering how the Fourier transform is defined, okay? So this is, I think, as pretty definitive as you can get within textbooks. Okay, and so now that I've reminded you what the definition is, can anybody tell me what like the key defining mathematical property of the Legendre transform is that allows it to do what it does? And so what I mean by, I don't know, a key mathematical property, in comparison, what you might say about the Fourier transform is that it's a linear expansion in the eigenstates of the translation operator, right? So you translate something, and you expand in terms of these exponentials, and they only change by a phase. And then this is very useful in many solving many equations, right? To do this sort of expansion. So that's kind of the property of the Fourier transform that you use. Anybody have any idea? This is an honest question. I'm going to stop bugging you guys to answer on the spot here. But can anybody even guess at what property the Legendre transform has that enables it to do what it does? Okay, and just to drive this home, right? This is the link between between Lagrangian and Hamiltonian mechanics, which, right? These are the two most important formulations of both classical and quantum physics. They are, in some sense, or I think in a very specific sense, they're more fundamental than any force that we worry about, right? They kind of sit at a lower level than electromagnetism or gravity or anything like that. They're closer to the information theoretic level. And so I really do think it's reasonable to say that this is the transformation that binds together the fundamental operating systems of the universe. I don't think that's hyperbole. I think it's totally real. And I don't think almost any of the physicists know what it is. Okay, so it turns out that F and G are Legendre transforms of each other if and only if their first derivatives are inverse functions. That's the answer. This turns out to be equivalent to that very complicated description that Arnold gave. Arnold was at least explicit. If you look at things like Goldstein, it's not even clear that it's mathematically well-defined. So my claim is that essentially no physicists are taught this in any kind of a sensible manner, even though from a understanding the world perspective, I think it's like totally key. I think it's probably the case that maybe it doesn't really matter. Physicists, as they practice today, know. At least it probably doesn't make them any better graduate students, any better slave researchers, because if it did, then they would probably know it. And I'm going to argue, although I'll mostly assume through the rest of the talk, that this is not an exceptional case. That in fact, there's many situations like this where just very few people know the correct way to think about something, even though it's super important, even though it's right at the center of everything that we care about. If you're actually interested more about the Legendre transform, I wrote some long blog posts because I was so fired up about this. As you can, I'm sure, I hope my enthusiasm comes through. I've been told it does from time to time. So if you want to know more about it, you can read that. But I'm going to give one more example here of something where I think that things can just be taught terribly and continue to be taught terribly for years and years and years, and we don't have good correction mechanisms. So my one other example, again, we're going to keep it elementary for right now. So the claim here, and this one I'm going to go into much less detail on, but the claim is that nobody wrote a linear algebra textbook that motivates and defines determinants in a sensible way until 1997, okay? I don't say it up here. The short thing is that they use determinants to prove that eigenvalues exist for complex valued matrices. And if you're going to use it right at the beginning kind of a linear algebra course, you end up defining the determinant as this mysterious object that nobody can interpret. And nobody has any idea what it does. And it's only much, much, much later that you find out the determinant is basically the volume element of your linear transformation corresponding to the matrix. And so if you are interested in that idea, you can Google down with determinants or see that site. But anyways, I actually think that, not only this didn't require any new like crazy proofs or ideas, it's winning in the sense that somebody finally wrote this book, and now more than 300 universities use it. Took 20 years to kind of sort that all out, including like, good places, Harvard, UPenn, Cornell, they all use this book for teaching things like first year physics students. Now I want you to consider that if Axler had just written a polemical article and put it on the archive, he said, everybody does this wrong, you should teach linear algebra differently. The original article wasn't that long, it was maybe 10 or 20 pages. It would be hopeless. If you just put that paper on the archive, you said it's out there, it's known, I've demonstrated how much better this is a way to approach things, it would never work its way into the curriculum. Axler had to write an entire new textbook in order to get this pretty singular modular idea to be changed in the way everything is taught. And I just think this is like way, way too hard. And physics information is sort of ossifying, or our pipeline is hardening, even though it's not optimal. Okay, so here's just some quick ages of the classic textbooks that we teach with. Not everything is my main criticisms are not going to be at all restricted just to textbooks, but these are useful because things can be so egregious and everyone will have looked at the textbooks, whereas if I picked specifics from fields, not everyone would be familiar. So these are just some of the ages. So the first year will be the first edition, or the first age, and the second one will be the latest edition, the last edition. And so there's a couple of these that are not crazy old, but many of them are many decades old. And pretty soon we're gonna be starting, you know, before I'm done, we're gonna be start measuring these in triple digit years. So I think this is amazing. Now I'm not criticizing oldness per se. It is not good to be flashy, that doesn't help. Newness is not valuable, but for its own sake, don't fix what isn't broken. But the key question is, do you think that these textbooks are ideal? And so based on those examples, and what I think could be many, many other examples, I think we should conclude they're very far from ideal. I think we educate more physicists than ever before, and when I use educate, I use this in a very liberal term, meaning both going from undergraduate and all the way up to when one researcher is trying to learn about some sort of new field or become acquainted, right? Postdocs and faculty members. So when I'm saying educated, I use it in that sense. More being educated than ever before. Basic physics is changing less, right? The rate at which we're kind of overturning new things in physics is going down. And so I think that means we should be investing more in carefully optimizing pedagogical material. Just like from an economic standpoint, you expect if things are going to stay the same for a while and you're going to be educating a tremendous number of people, it makes sense to invest in making really good pedagogical materials. And I think we're doing the opposite. We're allowing our researcher pipeline to just slowly decay. So if Landau and Lifshitz has a flaw, you can do what Axler could have stopped at. You can write up some supplementary notes or assign alternate reading if you're going to teach this. But these improvements, they don't propagate. People can copy your reading list. Maybe, you know, one professor copies your reading list and pass around your notes. But it's really impractical for them to improve on top of that, right? We just have notes on top of notes. And pretty soon nobody can keep, you know, you can't have more than two or three layers of that. If you want something that can propagate and can displace just like a single flawed section of Landau and Lifshitz, you need to write an entire textbook that is net better than Landau and Lifshitz, because you have to replace the whole thing. If your textbook is better on net, but is worse in certain parts, then the teaching of those parts will get worse, right? So you'll be better on net, you'll replace the whole thing, but not everything will be a strict improvement. Now, I'm not gonna give a whole bunch of examples, but I'm going to claim that this is not just about the Legendre transform or the determinant. These are just some elementary examples I picked to be sensible to as many people as possible. I think review articles or research articles are worse, and the textbooks are just the most obvious kind of unquestionable examples of this. So, you know, one of my pet peeves is when people say something like, you see this repeated all the time, classical sensitivity to initial conditions, as like an idea, doesn't extend to quantum chaos because the Schrodinger equation is linear. And this just turns out to be false, but it's something that's been repeated for many decades. So a lot of times the response I get to this, and as Rosie was so kind to me, she gave me this a response, something along these lines. I don't mean to attribute this to you, of course. But I think an intuitively sensible initial response is something, you know, this information is known. You know, maybe we don't teach Legendre transforms very well, but it is on Google. You know, if you go like to the fourth or fifth Google section, you click down through the third answer, you can find it. You know, out of the very lengthy Wikipedia page, it was eventually stuck in this definition of the Legendre transform. I didn't put in another question. Sorry, I said I wouldn't give any more questions, but this is another question. I'll just ask it rhetorically, though I won't make you raise your hands. Did you just think whether you think Wikipedia is that useful? Yeah, you're on board, people? So I think it's like super useful. Well, basically every fact on Wikipedia is accessible elsewhere on the internet. In principle, there are facts in Wikipedia that are only in books, but in practice, almost everything now is because of the way they require citations and how much easier it is to cite things online. In practice, almost everything in Wikipedia is available on the internet. But the fact that it's out there somewhere is not enough. Bringing everything together is critical. It is much faster to find, and central locations allow iterative improvement. By bringing all the facts to one place on Wikipedia, we can go again and again, and we can refine it, we can make a streamlined version, whereas if it's just 100 websites that are not coordinating, we can't do this. And I just think the amount of time, it can just change how much time it takes to learn something by a factor of 10 or more, and this just really has a big effect on people's ability to learn new fields, to connect two different fields that you don't have background in. A kind of corollary of this is that this idea that there is like a thing that the community knows. There are when you know things are discovered, research facts are put on the archive and they're known to the community is not good as a discrete category. And I don't just mean this in this like annoying way about, oh, didn't you realize there are gradations? I mean, I really think this has important implications for how we should organize expert knowledge. One thing you sometimes see is that researchers will get upset or dismissive when someone reinvents an old idea. You know, when all these physicists are like, rewriting all these machine learning papers, or these sorts of situations. And it gets a ton of citations, and then the people in the old field are like, oh my gosh, like we've known this for 30 years. What are these guys doing? And I think this comes out of this really, this bad mindset that like the point is to be first, and then like you won the foot race, and like that was the point, right? But of course, the idea is that if researchers are always hungry for useful techniques, so if you discover some technique, but nobody deploys it until it is reinvented in their own language, then it was not practically accessible to them, right? They did not wait for it to be put in their language because they don't like you. They waited for it to be put in their language because they literally couldn't understand what you were talking about. And the end goal is not for one person to know. The game doesn't end when one person knows. If it was, we wouldn't have moved past this norm that we were discussing before, that you it doesn't count if you publish it in a cryptographic manner, because you're not the point, right? Kind of human knowledge is the point. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is I'm going to just throw out a few ideas or some few things that I'd love to see kind of get implemented eventually. These are not supposed to be instructions for tool builders to go out and build this. Some of these things exist in various fashions, but I want to just throw them out there to get people thinking that these things are possible. So we're just going to start from the least ambitious, there's going to be four of them, to the most ambitious. And the idea is, when I say cutting edge here, I don't mean that that this ability would be cutting edge. What I mean is that it's applied to like cutting edge research, whereas especially the things at the bottom will only kind of make sense for documents that you would be investing a lot in. If you're writing a very good review paper, or you're going to write a textbook that was read by every physics graduate student, then it would be worth a lot of effort. Okay, so the first one is, just being able to give one-click feedback to draw an author's attention to an issue. So something where whatever, either reading in the browser or reading on your dedicated PDF reader, if you're printing out your PDFs, there's not much I can do to help here, but like, imagine that you're reading electronically, and you could give really seamless, effortless one-click feedback to the author to say, boy, this is confusing. I think this step is unjustified, or I don't get it. It's just like a right click. You say, oh, what's going on? And then the author, right, he looks at his document, and if this comes back to him and he gets something like this, he's like, oh, okay, I can kind of like see what's going on here, right? The fact that this is really easy for many people to make small contributions is like a key property that would make something like this work. So a slight complication of that is just to be able to write a very short message to the author. I saw a simpler derivation of this in some paper. So you would just type it in, right? And this was, is, it would be very much like Google Docs, but something that would be a standard that would be able to connect to all academic papers rather than having to put your paper in Google Doc and have the author use Google Doc. It would just be something like this, right? I don't know if you've ever edited like a text document using Google Docs where you write a document and you get your friends to comment on it, but it's very helpful. And if you could have these sorts of things from everyone who's reading your paper worldwide, I think it would be even more helpful. Okay, now here is where I'm hoping that Luis is going to be able to join us. Luis, are you there? We didn't hear the beeps.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Perfect. Everyone, let me see if I can get these.
Yes, so why don't you take over? What I'm here to do is
can you have an introduction?
Yes, no, that's what I was about to do. Actually, you know what, Luis, I'm gonna have to ask you to pronounce your last name for us. Batala?
Batala, it's fine.
Oh, well, you wanna say it a little bit better? What is the right way to say it?
War, actually.
Okay.
Me see. Can you guys see my screen?
We see your face right now, but we don't see your screen.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm going to do a quick, you pull that up and I'm going to do a quick introduction. So Luis works on, this is what he's going to be talking about. And he can describe his background, but Luis works on something called Fermat's Library, which is a website and a Chrome plugin to try to enable people to better discuss papers, to be able to have conversations around them that persist and are widely accessible. Luis, take it away.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Jess. You guys can already see the presentation, right? Just wanted to confirm.
Can we turn it up?
Yeah, we're. Hold on, just one second, Luis. We need to get the volume up on you.
Okay.
We'll try again.
Hello, guys. Can you hear me better?
No.
It's a little bit quiet.
Okay.
Thanks. We're working on it. By the way, you have just over 15 minutes.
No worries.
Is that going to be okay?
Yes.
Great.
Yes. Perfect. Let me know when I can start.
Go for it.
Okay, guys. So first of all, thank you very much, Jess, for the invitation and for allowing
louder.
Us to show. I'll try to talk louder, and the microphone is close to my mouth. So
yeah, put it a bit closer.
That's
good.
Easier
thanks.
Now. And so thanks, Jess, for giving us this opportunity to show Fermat's Library. So I created with three friends Fermat's Library 2.5 years ago. Fermat's Library, as Jess explained, is a platform for annotating academic papers. The name was actually inspired by Fermat's Last Theorem, which was famously scribbled by Fermat in a margin where he claimed that the margin was too short for the proof. Actually, almost 300 years later, Andrew Wiles come up with a 300-page proof of Fermat's Last Theorem. So definitely, that definitely couldn't fit the margin. But it serves to show that there's a lot of knowledge that it's kind of trapped in between the lines. And that was the inspiration for the name. So, here's how it works. So basically, we have a paper, and next to the paper there are a bunch of boxes. And if you click on one of these boxes, an annotation pops up, and we support a bunch of different materials such as image, videos, LaTeX, code, links to data that has been used in the paper, and pretty much anything that you can imagine that can help you better understand the specific section of a paper. So the Bitcoin paper, out of curiosity, was actually the first paper annotated in the platform, and so far probably one of the most viewed papers in Fermat's Library. What is the motivation? Why we decided to create a platform such as Fermat's Library? So if you think about it, papers are probably one of the densest pieces of text that a human can read. And you have scientists that are publishing fairly complex scientific discoveries, and sometimes with restrictions in terms of size imposed by the journal. So in the end, the incentives are not aligned for clarity or a proper explanation of every section of the paper. Sorry, guys, I'm just hearing myself, so I'm trying to make sure that I can speak at the same time. So that conflict ends up not being aligned with a proper explanation of every section of the paper. So it's actually not uncommon to see these in math or physics papers where you have an expression that is the author claims to be trivial, and then what trivial really means is more like this. So there's definitely a lot of content that is trapped in between these trivial claims, and that could be way easier to understand if you add support materials and annotations on the side. Additionally, we are seeing more and more online collaboration around papers. So in late 2015, Perenstau was working on a paper about the Erdős discrepancy problem when a reader of his blog, a German reader of his blog, wrote this comment there. And the comment, as you can see, it's almost the size of a tweet, so really, really small comment. And he pointed out that the problem, the Erdős discrepancy problem, which was posed by Paul Erdős, the great mathematician, 80 years ago, had a Sudoku-like flavor, and that some of the machinery that was being used to solve Sudoku could also be used here. And so this comment was actually the key to crack the Erdős discrepancy, and thanks to this comment, Terenstau, the Fields medalist, ended up publishing a proof for the Erdős discrepancy a few months later in 2016, which was probably one of the biggest milestones in number theory that year. And so how do you start a platform where you can basically annotate every academic paper? So that's a big kind of chicken and egg problem. And we actually didn't start as a platform. We started as a journal club. So we started by annotating a paper every week in the fields of math, physics, biology, economics. And there were like, we were annotating papers like the Bitcoin paper, the historical papers like the discovery of the neutron, the positron. And the idea was to generate interest about the annotations and the papers, and also get and the platform, and also to get people used to the interface, the annotation interface. And we got to that. We got to about 10 million people that visit the website every month and read the papers and the annotations that we do every week. And so now we are turning Fermat's library more into a platform. And so the first thing that we did to turn Fermat's library into a platform was to open the commenting and the annotation UI to anyone. So basically now we allow anyone to upload and annotate their own papers in the platform. So as you can see here, this is a screenshot of what it looks like. You can have your own papers in the platform, you can have folders, and you can upload, save, annotate, and share your annotations with other people. So you can share with other researchers in your lab, in your university. If you are a student reading papers, you can share it with other students. Or if you are participating in a journal club in your university, you can also upload papers, comment, annotate them, and share them with other people. So this was the first step to turn Fermat's library into a platform. Another thing that we did was a Chrome extension for Archive called Librarian. So Archive is where most papers live before they go to journals in the form of preprints. And Archive is we developed a Chrome extension that allows you to see all the commenting interface in every Archive paper without having to leave Archive. So you just install the Chrome extension, and all of a sudden you have the comments on the archive papers, and you also have a few extra features that were requested by a lot by archive users, such as reference extraction and beep tags for all the archive papers. So for us, it was a kind of a growth hack to have people install the extensions and install the extension. And now every time you go to an archive paper, you see the comments there. Archives is particularly one of the things that we've seen is that, especially in areas such as machine learning and deep learning, which is basically the fastest growing category on archive in terms of papers being submitted every month, comments are particularly important because new papers are being submitted so fast that people start reading them and working on them before they actually go to journals. So you need a way to distinguish good quality work from bad work, and Librarian is actually one of the tools that people are in machine learning and deep learning fields. So, as you can see here in the image, you can see in this case a paper about deep learning, and the author Ian Goodfellow, which is a top researcher in machine learning, answering questions about this paper. So he's kind of doing an AMA about the paper, and he answered more than 50 questions about this paper. I think this was 2 weeks ago. And so what are the future perspectives? We believe that there's a lot of potential energy that can be unlocked if more open discussions about science happen online. And we believe that in 10 years, there's going to be way more people collaborating online and sharing knowledge about academic papers online. And Fermat's Library, there's a lot of potential to solve a lot of big problems if we get to scale, if we have thousands of scientists annotating and annotating and commenting papers in the platform, such as the peer review problem, paper recommendations. Those are some of the problems that we think we can solve. And we want Fermat's Library to be the platform where all these discussions take place. So thank you very much, guys.
Hey, thanks very much, Luis. Hopefully we'll switch over. Let's see, I think we need the guy to take over, don't we? Oh yeah, sorry, no, my mistake. Questions for Luis?
Have you heard of this platform called Peer Library, which seems to do something very similar?
Peer Library?
Peer Library?
I haven't heard about them.
So, peerlibrary.com. They also have papers and annotations on it. I was wondering if you taking a look. It kind of plays into our discussion today about a proliferation of tools that do similar things.
Okay. I'm going to check that.
Peer, like just like your peer in library.
Okay.
And I guess like another...
Do they host papers or are...
Yeah, they
or
do.
It's just comments, and then they have links to papers.
They do host papers and they have like kind of annotations next to a rendering of the PDF of the paper.
Okay.
I mean, another thing that's similar to what you're proposing that I see more people doing is both authoring of papers and textbooks, in your case, on GitHub. So you can have mm-hmm. papers and I think textbooks more like you have an open textbook, it's all written in Markdown. You can kind of submit pull requests to the textbooks to improve a part of it. And it's kind of like automatically published from the source code. So that's kind of like one way to do what Jess was saying, maybe, where you want to improve a particular part of a textbook, so you could actually submit a pull request to that, and like, you know, that rolls out more in like a version rather than editions.
If we can talk. The licensing thing generally prohibits that with almost all textbooks that are out today. Yeah, please.
I'm a biologist, so for physics, I can see that you could. Because it seems like for tools like this, you need to have a bunch of people commenting on one document, whether it's your own manuscript or something else, for it to really have value. And in physics, you're able to leverage the buy-in to the archive to have this happen. Have you thought about ways to move it into biology that might overcome the reluctance of biology authors to critique each other's papers on public platforms, and just to get multiple people commenting on a paper?
So one of the things, I think there's also, by the way, there's also a bioarchive.
Yes, that's the kind of thing, but I don't think there's any or hardly any actual comment on papers on bioarchive. We put our manuscripts there, but only when we submit them to journals for peer review. There's not an open peer review process happening in biology.
Interesting. Well, it's definitely one of the things that we have been doing to kind of like, and again, there's no silver bullet here to incentivize people to comment and to annotate their own papers. One thing that has been working really well for us is just reaching out to authors and doing these kinds of AMAs, where AMA stands for Ask Me Anything, where they just, the one that I was showing before with Ian, they just allocate one day and then they ask people asking questions, and then they just go there and answer any questions that that people might have about the paper. It's definitely a problem coming up with incentives for people to comment their own papers. And one of the things that we also have been doing is every time there's a comment on one of the archive papers that we think it's interesting, we automatically send an email to the author suggesting that he goes to the platform and answers that question, or you know, just talks with the person that wrote the comment. Another thing that I think, I'm not sure if this actually helps us or hurts us, but all the comments in the platform are not anonymous. So there's always that we need identity in this case for someone to leave a comment, which might lead to less comments. But at the same time, one of the things that we learned from these is that all the comments are actually, you know, the quality is really good. If you go to the AMA that Ian did last week, for instance, there was not a single comment that was just that was not good. He answered all the comments there, and the discussion was really the quality of the discussion was really good. So this is something. This is another thing that we learned from
I think we have time for one
forcing
more
people to have identity associated with the comments.
Sorry.
I just wondered if the source code for all your work is available, if it's open source.
We thought about that. We haven't open sourced the Fermat's library code, and the reason is that we just didn't have time to kind of like think about how we are going to do it and how we are going to organize, you know, collaboration and how we are going to structure that. But it's definitely a possibility, and we have quite some people asking us to do that.
Okay, thanks. Just a quick, very quick comment. Just to compliment what you've been doing, which is really great. There are two other platforms, probably you heard of them. One is called Autoria. It's basically collaborative writing of scientific papers, so it complements, I think, what you've been doing. And another one is pubpub.org, and again, it's a complement. It's not about it's about writing and publishing. Pubpub, I think it's worth a look.
We've seen some other platforms try to solve this problem. I think the main problem here is convincing people sometimes to change their behavior and then go to another website just to read the comments, and that's actually been one of the things that we've tried to solve the problem of like not forcing people to change their behavior and kind of like integrating as seamlessly as possible into what people are already doing. And so that's why we decided to build the Chrome extension for Archive, so that you can go to and continue reading the papers on Archive. You just have an overlay that is already there, that you don't have to kind of like go to another website to see. And I think that's one of the biggest problems for people that try to crack this problem.
Do you have APIs built in?
If we provide APIs or if we are using other people's APIs?
Built yourself APIs for the tool.
No, we haven't built any APIs. We are actually working with the Archive team to have access to some of their APIs that could make our work easier, especially because we want to build a recommendation engine for a librarian. So if you're looking at an Archive paper, which other papers you should be looking at and reading, and so that would be an extra button in the Chrome extension, and for that we need some data from Archive to build the recommendation engine, and working with them to have access to that API. But we haven't built any API ourselves. I just wanted to point out, I'm not sure, but this is started as a side project. We started this while we were working in our company. So this is still something that we do during the weekends. And even with 10 million people going to the website every month, it's still a side project. So our time is a little limited sometimes to work on new features. But it's definitely something that we are probably going to release in the next couple of months.
Thank you.
Another question at the front?
Yeah, I was just going to ask about mobile platforms, whether you've looked into what you can do on the mobile or the Archive app or not.
I'm not sure if I got the question, but you're asked about mobile compatibility. Is that it? How does the platform look on mobile? Yeah, it's I think it's very complicated to solve that problem, especially because you need somehow to, you can't use PDFs. I think you need to get the full text of the paper and then render it differently, because it's hard to read PDFs on a mobile phone. And especially if you add the annotation layer, we've thought about that problem a lot, but we haven't come up with a solution to that. I think in the end, it's you need to get rid of the PDF format, get all the paper information, and then render it differently. Right now, if you go to Fermat's library on mobile, it's not great, and the website is optimized for desktop, not mobile. But it's definitely a problem that we have to solve, because we are seeing increasingly number of people going to the website and requesting that it looks better on mobile, the experience.
Okay. So let's thank Louis again.
So I'm not going to. I had a few more things I was going to do, but we're out of time. I wanted to make one point, just because it was a major point in the rest of my slides. I wanted to push back a little bit on one of the comments, and a refrain I've heard a few times before is that, oh man, people are building tools and they don't get picked up, and this is just going to be more tools. This is how things always look before they get taken off. Dropbox was not the first company that allowed you to do online cloud storage. And if you were looking at the different online cloud storages at the beginning, they would all have looked very similar, especially if you hadn't really dug into the details. The things that decide that something is going to take off are often quite subtle. And I think there are many cases like this that we could talk about. I think if we see many tools and they're not working, I think the proper thing to do is to sit down and try to figure out, you know, what is it that we want? Why, when I think about using it, I don't use it? What is the barriers? And then writing that sort of information up and making it accessible to the people who put in time to build tools. And so that's part of what we hope would might come out of the white paper. So that's it. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Jess.
Thank you, guys.